Back on board the White Spirit, the divers have already gone down to examine the Centaur tanks. While we waited for them, I spoke to Dr. Julian Whitewright, who's helping to coordinate the latest investigation.
The project has two main purposes. Firstly, to understand whether or not we can apply terrestrial heritage protection legislation to sites and monuments that are located underwater off the coasts of Britain, and specifically off the coast of England. At the moment, only shipwrecks are protected under law, and other types of sites, such as submerged prehistoric landscapes and things like that, although they can theoretically be protected, none of them are actually practically protected. So this project is really a case study to find out whether or not the terrestrial legislation is suitable for purpose, or fit for purpose, to be extended into the offshore zone. English Heritage are very keen to do this, so that all of our heritage, whether it's on the land or under the sea, is actually treated in the same way. And in time, it may be that shipwrecks would be protected under this legislation rather than under their existing specialist protection.
So what kind of legislation can be put into place, and how would it protect these wrecks?
Currently, the shipwreck legislation is called the Protection of Wrecks Act, which was passed in 1973. And this covers ships, and that includes, when it says shipwreck, it includes aeroplanes and vehicles that have become deposited on the seafloor. And those vessels that are deemed of high enough significance can be protected. So not everything is protected, only the things that are deemed important and significant are protected. If something is protected, it means that public access to the site is then very, very restricted, and you have to get a special license to be able to visit the site. What the project is looking into is whether or not we can apply another piece of legislation, which was originally drafted to deal with terrestrial archaeology, which is called the Ancient Monuments and Archaeological Areas Act, which was passed in 1979. This has been applied to a couple of wrecks in Scotland, and the advantage of it is that it protects the vessel in terms of making it an offence to touch it or tamper it with it or remove anything, but people can still visit the site. So divers could still visit the site and take photographs and experience the site in the context that it's in, but it would be illegal for them to actually do anything to it. The same as if they visit Stonehenge, they're not allowed to chip bits off the stones or whatever.
So have these wrecks been interfered with before?
It's difficult to say. I think on the base of the diving field work that we've done, it doesn't seem that they've been interfered with deliberately. There have been instances of other vessels. There was one recently of a World War I submarine where a piece of the submarine was stolen and deliberately removed. But with these vessels, they seem to have naturally degraded on the seafloor with the tanks and the bulldozers. And they have had a little bit of damage from fishing activities and anchoring of vessels, possibly dive boats, on them. But there doesn't seem to have been any deliberate destruction of them or deliberate removal of pieces of them. The landing craft itself is much harder to assess because it's broken up into so many pieces, which is the result of it being shot at to be deliberately sunk by the Navy in 1944. So that's much more difficult to assess. The only piece that has been deliberately removed was a £2,000 bomb that was found on the site, which just happened to be there, I think, by accident. It wasn't to do with the site, but that was removed by the Navy's bomb disposal team. So that is the only thing that's been deliberately removed as far as we're aware.
Not long afterwards, the divers returned to the boat. I spoke to archaeologist Brandon Mason as he came back on board.
Oh, it was good. It was not as clear as it was in July, but the conditions weren't too bad. It was murky, but as we got close to each of the tanks and bulldozers, they sort of loomed out of the green, gloomy darkness, and we could identify where we were on the site and where the other vehicles were in relation to that one. So we began surveying. We got a lot of work done, really sort of fixed some of the positions of the various vehicles, knocking the conger eels and fish out of the way, of course, so that we could find some of the smaller objects as well, like the propellers and the proposed field gun. We managed to find that on this dive as well.
As we returned to harbour, I spoke again to Brandon about his experiences on the dive.
I don't think I've ever done a dive like that, actually. The atmosphere, the clarity, the water, the site itself is absolutely phenomenal. When we dived here in July earlier this year, we had unparalleled visibility. It was about 20 metres, it was calm, we had a really great slack window, and as we dropped down onto the first tank, we could just see the whole site laid out before us. And you really got a sense that these things had just come straight off a wreck, been deposited on the seabed, and survived in remarkable condition. The site itself was teeming with life, all sorts of schooling fish, large conger eels, and the tanks themselves in various orientations with the bulldozers behind, and tons of munitions just scattered all over the seabed. Really, really quite phenomenal as a really discreet site clustered together.
Is it dangerous?
It is a little bit dangerous because of those munitions. We surveyed the entire site itself, putting up baselines on a north, south and east, west orientation. And part of that involved knocking pins into the seabed. You had to choose your location pretty carefully when putting those in, to be honest. You didn't want to be putting it on a high explosive. As far as the wrecks are concerned, they're quite small vehicles and there's not really any danger of entrapment or entanglement on those themselves.
And what's the state of preservation of those tanks?
Well, they've survived remarkably well considering the 70 odd years that they've been there. They are obviously tanks and bulldozers. There's no involved archaeological interpretation necessary to identify them. And they're largely intact. There are a few elements where on the underside of some of the tanks we've got corrosion that's revealed some of the engines and the cavities inside. And the tracks, the track vehicles have largely fallen away. There's also a jeep on the seabed that's been broken up and one of the bulldozer blades is detached, and these latter two are probably the result of mooring activities from fishing boats, diving vessels and other users of the sea.
And what would you like to see happen to these wrecks?
I would like to see them be protected, but still enabling visitor access, diving access. These sites have been identified by divers, and they should be continued to be enjoyed for divers as well, but there needs to be some sort of level of protection and recognition of their importance to the history of this nation.
This is a view shared by the project's coordinators. Dr. Julian Whitewright.
I think the landing craft project has been hugely successful. We've pretty much achieved everything we set out for in terms of the aims and objectives of the project. And in particular, what we have found is that the landing craft and the vehicle assemblage are very suitable for protection under the Ancient Monuments and Archaeological Areas Act. This is obviously one of the objects of the project, was to provide a case study for the application of this act for the project.
The two centaurs on board LCTA 2428 were the only ones of Force J that did not make it to Juno Beach. Although some were delayed, the remaining 30 centaurs and 8 Sherman tanks of the Royal Marine Armoured Support Group made it to Juno Beach and fought bravely over the next 2 weeks. However, of the 80 centaurs that were allocated to the entire invasion, only 48 are believed to have made it to Normandy, and the number that were left when the unit was withdrawn 2 weeks later is unknown. Sources also suggest that up to 29 landing craft Mark V were lost during the invasion. For those that did make it to the beaches, D-Day was an experience that many of them will never forget. We'll let Lieutenant Commander Norman Vingo have the last word.
Lots of smoke. Sky was sort of darkened. Very, very noisy with the different firing that was going on. We had selected targets on the Juno Beach at Corsol. And these were known to those in charge of the assault, and they were known and described to my captain, Lieutenant Prentice, RNVR, at a pre-invasion conference, and he explained to me after the conference, he said, well, we've got a task ahead, and he showed me the charts with various German strong points at Courcelles, fortified houses, gun emplacements, which we were having to duel with, or our tank was, and that's what happened. My captain was in charge of the firing. He was selecting these targets and telling the tank captain, who was on the bridge for the run-in. One of these included the strong point known as WN-29. That had an 88mm gun in a casemate near the entrance to Courcelles. It's still there, badly damaged.
Centaurs Under the Sea was produced by the Hampshire and White Trust for Maritime Archaeology. The opening radio clip is an original recording first broadcast on the 6th of June 1944 and is the property of the BBC. The producers wish to thank Brandon Mason, Julian Whitewright, Alison Mayer and Lieutenant Commander Norman Vingo for their contributions. The presenter was Stephen Fisher.